ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This August, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
Flowers don't usually inspire fierce competition.
Unless you're asking Australians to pick their favourites.
This Science Week, we're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Vote now for Australia's favourite at abc.net.au/science.
Celebrate Science Week with us in August on ABC Radio National and at abc.net.au/science.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. If you have at all scratched the surface of your own family history, you'll know some dark stuff can lurk in your ancestry. And stars, they're just like us. Comedian Luke McGregor went digging into his Scottish ancestry and found a very grisly chapter. You'll hear his story in the next 30 minutes. And I would love to hear what surprise discoveries you've made researching your family tree. Also ahead, would you give up on your career if you realised it didn't align with your ethics? Plus, does your real estate agent actually need all that information about you? And is that data secure enough? Spoiler, probably not, and probably not. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, what makes your city, your suburb, recognisable? I'm not talking about the Sydney Opera House or the Big Banana or the iconic destinations on a bucket list for travellers. I'm talking about the small, ordinary, sometimes even ugly parts of a city that make it feel unique. Canberra's bus shelters, for example, they were designed back in the 1970s. They were once described as concrete monstrosities and orange-spotted fungi. Well, they've just been added to the ACT Heritage Registry. And a couple of years back, the town of Penguin in Tasmania rallied to save their quirky penguin-shaped rubbish bins from being replaced by council. What is it about things that we once considered ugly that become iconic pieces of public infrastructure? Why do we love them so much? And how does the design of seemingly ordinary objects in public spaces change the way we use them? I'm about to dive into it with an architecture advocate and a public art curator, but I would love to hear from you. Tell me about the piece of public infrastructure that feels iconic to your community. Is it a bus stop? Is it a bin? Is it a building? What does this say about the place you live? Here with me is Izzy White, an architecture advocate who makes content about how design influences the way we move around our cities. Izzy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Tegan.
So the impetus for this is very much the Canberra bus shelters. If someone isn't familiar with them, can you describe them for me, please?
Yeah, I sure can. And I'm based in Melbourne, so when this news story popped up on my feed, it was the first time I'd seen and heard of these beautiful little things.
Oh.
But yeah, I'm very happy to describe them. They're sort of these circular little concrete pods. They're very simple structures. They've got flat roofs. And the pod itself is this sort of light yellow colour. But I think the thing that's so gorgeous about them is these circular cutouts that act as the windows. And they have this bright orange trim. And inside these little pods is a bright orange bench seat to match. So if anyone hasn't seen them, hopefully that gives them a bit of an indication of what they look like.
I think, Izzy, like if you have seen them, they're unforgettable, right? Like, and if you go to Canberra, you can buy, you know, coffee mugs and stuff in the shape of these pods. How about other cities? What sort of what kind of iconic moments have you thought about other Australian cities?
I grew up in Brisbane, and I think what's so interesting about these bus stops in terms of becoming sort of an iconic piece of city identity, when I compare it to Brisbane City, I actually think the same sort of thing could be said for the City Cats. They're not a building per se, but they have the same role. They sort of started as City Cats and then became Kitty Cats, and now there's the City Dogs with the beautiful bluey cartoons on them. And it's a really interesting thing because when we talk about cities and things that create city identity, there's not many types of buildings or infrastructure that are repeatable. public transport is pretty unique like that. And often when we see modern development, things tend to compete with each other. They have to be new or the new icon. And I think that's what makes these bus stops so unique. And in Brisbane's case, you know, the City Cats, because they're repeatable, which means people all over the city get to know them. And it really does bake itself into the idea of a city identity.
Izzy, it's so funny because I am based in Brisbane as well. And when you said City Cat, I have a big old smile on my face. Someone's just reminded me I probably should explain what they are. If you're not from Brisbane, it's not a cat. It's a catamaran. It's a ferry. It's how we get across the river. It's one of our forms of public transport. And it's only 50 cents fares. You said that they do a similar role, Izzy. The repeatability is part of it. Mm. What role is this in your mind?
Oh, good question. Big question too. You know, when people visit a city for the first time, often their first experience of a place will be public transport. If they're arriving from an airport, if they're arriving by car, they tend not to have their own personal car to get around. And so Australia has a really long history of our cities relying on private car ownership to get us from A to B. And rethinking of these public networks as the sort of front door to a city is kind of the role they play. And as our cities grow and change and turn from sort of smaller cities into big metropolises, I think we will see a huge shift in how we think about public infrastructure. I think we've seen that already in Sydney and Melbourne recently. They've just finished some incredible metro stations that have won a whole bunch of architecture awards. And I think what we're looking at there is an understanding that this sort of infrastructure has to go beyond just pragmatics. It has to offer identity and beauty and joy and safety to get people to use what is a shared infrastructure network as opposed to private car ownership. So it's got a huge role to play in modern city making.
You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting to self-confessed architecture nerd Izzy White. We're talking about public infrastructure and the way that a city or a town can develop a very unique version of this, inspired in part by Canberra's concrete bus stops being added to the Heritage Register in recognition of the historical and community significance. I'd love to know about a public infrastructure that feels iconic to your community. You're also giving me texts on 0418 226 576. A couple of Canberrans shouting out the bus shelters. Juliet says Canberra bus shelters are wonderfully designed for the freezing winter weather. They reach the ground, provide shelter from the wind, and one can see the bus approaching. Another says, I lived in Canberra for 25 years and the now heritage-listed bus shelters do exactly what their name suggests. They provide excellent shelter in bad weather, unlike new bus, quote-unquote, shelters in any Australian city. Anna is shouting out the post boxes around Fitzroy in Melbourne, which were lovingly restored by a passionate volunteer. Well, talking about iconic public infrastructure, one thing that I have noticed around my city of Brisbane and never really thought of it as being unique to here is the traffic signal boxes with art on them. But apparently it's a Brisbane thing, and I actually have the curator of this project here with me, Beth Jackson, who runs an art consultancy specialising in public art, overseeing this Brisbane City Council-run project turning traffic signal boxes into works of community art. Beth, welcome.
Hi.
Is there any... We'll talk about the art in a second. I do want to know if there's any particular Brisbane landmark that you hate, that you actually love. That you think is ugly but that you love.
Oh, wow. I've got public art in my brain. I think sometimes, yeah, public art can be a love-hate thing. And, yeah, we had a public artwork years ago, which was a hand reaching to the sky with one finger raised, right? And it got called the Hopperwadi. like that was just a vernacular kind of name that happened. And obviously that wasn't the title of the artwork, but it does sort of speak to this way that public art can reach into a public imagination. And unfortunately that public artwork was in public space, but it was privately owned. It was part of a development. And then when the new building owner, when the building ownership changed hands, the new owner got rid of the artwork and commissioned a new artwork because of that. But in my view, I thought, oh, no, you've just removed a bit of legend from, you know, our streets, you know. But, yeah, so that sort of popped into my head. I don't know whether that answered your question.
The legendariness, I think, is really interesting, this idea that there's a story attached to the object. It's not just about the object itself.
Yeah.
Tell me about the signal boxes. Actually, maybe a bit of context. If you haven't noticed them before, maybe you don't even know what these boxes are.
Yeah, right. So every signalised intersection has a little cabinet, a street cabinet. They're not little, actually. They're like over 2 metres tall. And they're in these really prominent locations, and they're very prone to graffiti because they're just a blank canvas, if you like. And so a long time ago, over 20 years ago, Brisbane City Council decided that painting them with artwork was a way of, you know, preventing that graffiti because, you know, generally artists, even graffitiists tend to respect other artists' work. So I think other cities have done traffic signal box painting programs, but Brisbane's is the longest and largest, and we do the whole city. And so there's over 1,000 boxes over, you know, an enormous area. Obviously, Brisbane's a huge area and a really large council area. So, yeah, we refresh the program by doing about 70 box artworks a year. And so we release them on our website, people subscribe, and then, you know, they get, they apply when the boxes are released, and then they get dished out on a first in, first serve basis. So it is a truly inclusive, you know, all ages and abilities program. So we get artwork by kids, we get, you know, by people with disabilities, by the elderly, by family groups and schools. And yeah, so it's just and also by really good artists, I have to say. Like it's kind of a competitive program. We've got people that have been trying to get a box for years. So they go like hotcakes, and it's kind of a big deal to get a box now. Like it's a thing in Brisbane. And I it's a delight to run the program because we get heaps of love for, you know, people love doing, putting their mark on the city, I guess. Yeah.
When you go to other cities and you see those blank boxes, you're like, oh, wasted opportunity.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. And we get feedback from people, like people that come from overseas here saying, oh, you're so lucky you have this. Like it's the first thing we noticed when we got here. And, you know, it's just for us, it's just part of the fabric now. But yeah, it is really special.
So when Izzy was talking before about bus shelters or metro stations or whatever, those are things that people really interact with. You don't have to interact with a traffic signal box. What's the significance of them for you, Izzy? For Beth, sorry.
You don't have to interact with them, but they do become this experience like that you do at the lights. So this commuter journey, and they are sort of wedded to the infrastructure, but the significance of them, I guess, is just that personalization of this very anonymous infrastructure. So people, yeah, you see some personal touch, like a little note in the margins of a book, and I guess their accessibility, like often we don't have time to go to galleries, even if we're art lovers, you know. And so it's this giant outdoor art gallery, and you get to integrate it into your everyday life. Yeah.
Izzy, what are your thoughts on the signal boxes, this idea that you're sort of interacting with them as you're moving through a city in a similar way to public transport?
Yeah, I think there's huge overlap there. It's been wonderful listening to sort of the explanation of this on the other side of the radio. Yeah, repeated elements in people's lives. It really is what builds in identity, pride, and joy. You know, the idea of a beauty standard or what we think is beautiful is often actually just a reflection of what is familiar to us. So the more that you see something, the more it sort of embeds itself in your memory bank or sort of visual library of what you consider to be part of your journey and life. And I think any city that can come up with something that is unique to that city, so for Canberra, the bus stops, for Brisbane, these beautiful little artworks, it's really important because having diverse experiences across cities is what creates tourism and therefore economy and all the things that come with that. So it sounds simple, but all of these big, big concepts show up in tiny decisions of how we treat our city and its infrastructure and therefore how people feel about their city.
Well, you're telling me how you feel about your city today on the text line. Rebecca says, Maryborough in Queensland has walk and don't walk pedestrian traffic lights in the image of Mary Poppins with her umbrella down, red, or up, green. The author was born in Maryborough in 1899. Margaret says, the ferries are a treasured part of Sydney. There's a song by Bernard Bolan, The Rose Bay Ferry. And Chris has called in. Chris, your area in Melbourne has transferred something that literally started out pretty crappy. Tell me the story of what's happened in Werribee.
I think everyone in Melbourne would know that Werribee used to stink to high heaven because of the sewerage system. And it was, in fact, parents would say, I'm going to take you, you've been naughty, I'm going to take you over to get the smells of Werribee. Anyway, it's changed dramatically. I think about 20 years ago, they changed the sewerage system and then they turned all those flotation ponds into area for birds, and the birds have discovered it, and it's just been incredible. Internationally, highly recognised. So we deserve the international award.
I'm giving you the Life Matters International Gold Star for Werribee. Chris, thank you so much for the call. Turning a sewage site into something that's now a bird sanctuary, absolutely gorgeous. Another text on the text line from Katie saying, as a young person in the 80s training to be an architect, I worked with Clem Cummings. He designed the Canberra bus shelters. Iconic design. I'm so happy they're still around. Thank you so much, Katie. Izzy, what a legacy to have worked on that project.
Definitely. And, you know, when I was sort of listening to some of the texts you were reading out earlier about how these little bus shelters really seem to protect people from the weather. And I think one of the reasons these bus shelters are such a great opportunity to talk about the merits of keeping old design is because we sort of legally can't really build like that anymore. When we talk about public infrastructure design, which I've never worked in, but I've worked with a lot of architects who have, it's so prescribed mainly through the lens of anti-vandalism and anti-crime. And when we see those bus shelters almost all over Australia, which is more or less a steel bench and a clear perspex screen behind you, a lot of that is to do with maintaining sight lines at all times. And these little concrete pods, I mean, really, they're sort of a bit of a dead-end corner, which in modern day city design, architects aren't allowed to do anymore. So, yeah, it's really important that we do get to protect these things because we probably can't build like that again, at least not for the foreseeable future.
So the idea of heritage listing it is important to you then, Izzy. What other public infrastructure should we consider protecting?
Such a good question. Heritage listing is important. And there are things, of course, that we should protect. But I do wonder sometimes if we could just have a better attitude towards renovation and reuse rather than demolition. And I think if we were able to do that better, we could probably rely less on protections, which come with their own sort of come with their own difficulties when you're trying to move and evolve cities with contemporary needs. I should say though, that one of the issues with renovating and reusing is that it's a lot more work for a modern day developer to be able to peel apart an old piece of structure and work out if the materials are safe or contaminated or if the building codes have changed. And we haven't made it easy enough for developers to do that. It's basically easier to come in and demolish and start again. And so if we do want to see better reuse in our cities of things that we love, we've really got to change the way that we sort of set up all of our systems to let modern development happen.
Beth, how would you like to see our public infrastructure protected so that we have this right mix of renewal and maintaining our heritage?
Oh, wow. I think, yeah, it does come back a little bit to people and identity and sense of place. So, yeah, it is about making places unique. And I think, yeah, when you find something special like the Canberra bus shelters, you know, that's a icon of that place. And I think it's important, yeah, that we think about that at all scales, like you're saying. And so the traffic signal boxes are important because they refresh, you know, a place. So yeah, there's place making and there's place shaking, if you like. And It's lovely that the traffic signal boxes change over time and we get to see a new have a new experience of the same place. So you need both. I think you do need both, but I think that sort of people-centred understanding of urban space is really important.
So Izzy, for someone who's walking through their town today, what do you hope they take from the surroundings that they might not have noticed before?
This is a great question, hard to answer, but I think being observant and curious are just lifelong traits everyone should carry. Everything you look at in your city has been designed and made by someone somewhere. And I think sometimes we walk past these objects and these things and we sort of take so much of it for granted. But to really engage, I think people would be surprised that operators like Queensland Rail are hugely responsible for the design of transport state, particularly railway stations. And so if you ever see, an architecture firm squeeze in design outside of the sort of pragmatic needs of safety, security, CCTV footage, of anti-vandalism, when you see someone get it in there, to applaud it, sing about it, make noise about it so that you can get more of it in your city, really public opinion and public conversation is what gets us to better design outcomes in the long run.
Well, Izzy, Beth, thank you both so much for chatting with me today. Izzy White is an architecture advocate. She makes content about how design influences the way we move around our cities. Beth Jackson is director and curator of Artfully, an arts consultancy specialising in public art. They run the Brisbane City Council's Traffic Signal Box public art project, which is called Art Force Brisbane. Thank you for your texts as well. One says, I live in Melbourne and grew up in Deep Dean, near a girls' home with girls from the Stolen Generations. A couple went on to live in the towers at Atherton Gardens in Fitzroy, where legendary First Nations musicians Archie Roach and Ruby Hunter also lived. The towers are iconic to Melbourne, an important part of Melbourne heritage. Christine says artwork in rural settings using their wheat silo that are covered in art that showcases their town. Well, if you love talking about art and design and architecture, you should check out By Design with Anthony Burke. You can find that on ABC Listen. It's always a great tale, but do stick around a bit longer here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up soon, comedian Luke McGregor's sordid family history. I'd love to know what you found when you've started investigating your own ancestry. But first, the legal loopholes that might be making the personal data on your rental application less secure than you'd like. Renters, listen up. If you've ever had to give over hundreds of points of ID in a quest to find somewhere to live, maybe to multiple real estate agencies on all those digital rental application forms, you might have wondered what happens to all that data. Why do these people need to know so much about me? What happens to all this super personal stuff I'm flinging out into the wilds of the internet? Is my data secure? Well, here with me to unpack Rent Tech is Rae Johnston from Download This Show. She has been investigating this industry and she has some concerns. Rae, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us what Rent Tech is if we haven't been as head down, bum up in it as you have been recently.
So ultimately, Rent Tech is all of those online forms and apps that you use to either apply for a property or log maintenance requests, pay your rent, anything that is required of you as a modern day tenant that we more often than not don't have the option to use more manual processes for. But this series in particular is zeroing in on those application forms that we do find online that are asking for what the Privacy Commissioner has now deemed as excessive amounts of our personal data.
I mean, if I was a landlord or a rental property manager, I would want to know, feel like I had enough information about the person who was applying. Who gets to say what's excessive?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it's a really good point. And we have spoken to, in this series, representatives of both landlords and real estate agents about why exactly they need all of this information. And it seems like there's been a little bit of a situation where the water's boiling slowly and the frog needs to jump out of the pot. Yeah, there hasn't been any regulation around this. And the amount of information that's being asked has now reached its capacity, really. We're talking about things like ethnicity, health issues, social media handles, you know, more pay stubs than are required by banks to give you a loan. And I think one of the most damning things that we've uncovered in this series is that if you feel uncomfortable about giving over that information and you choose not to supply it, your renter score, which is a thing I've discovered exists, is lower, and you'll realistically not be able to find a home to rent. So renters are now in competition with each other to supply all of this personal information, the kind of thing that we're told to never put online, especially in one place because of things like data breaches.
Okay, so all right, so you've given it over. Where does all the data go?
Well, this is one of the big problems as well, because even though these forms might contain everything about you ever, all of the things we're told not to put online, most real estate agencies aren't beholden to privacy law. They're technically too small of a business. Each individual franchise is looked at. So whatever these particular rent tech platforms are using for their own data storage and encryption is what's holding everything together. And I've looked into this because I had everything leaked of my own information in a breach like this. When we did our opt-out series for Download This Show, I worked out that that's where all of my personal information ended up online from. But they officially don't have to notify the Privacy Commissioner when it happens. So people aren't aware of this, and I felt like they should be.
That is great. If the host of Download This Show can have her data breached, then what hope do the rest of us have?
And that's really the point, isn't it? You know, we can do everything as safely as possible, but when there's a power imbalance in play here where we either hand over this info or don't have somewhere to live, you know, what can be done about this? Because it's not really very fair.
So you took a look at what happens if tenants don't give over that information, ask them, as you said before. You spoke to John Gilmovich, who's a licensed real estate agent and the head of the Property Owners Association. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
If there is insufficient data being collected or lacking data, then unfortunately their application, the tenant's application, will go to the bottom.
So that's what you said before, Ray. Why do you see that this is being such a strong problem?
I think when we are asking for people's information that really doesn't have any relevancy to their ability to be a good tenant, there is the potential for discrimination. You know, the way that real estate agents choose tenants is really opaque. There is no standardized regulation around this. So there is a really high risk of discrimination. They might choose that they don't want someone of that ethnicity, you know, someone with particular health issues. They might look at your social media and decide that they don't like your political stance on things, and ultimately not give you a home, which is, I might remind everyone, a human right.
So this is a series that you've done for Download This Show. Obviously, people can listen to it and get the full story, but if there's something that someone could do today, Ray, to protect themselves better, what would it be?
Yeah, I think understanding your rights, contacting the Privacy Commissioner as well. This is something that she is looking into. We have spoken to her extensively for this series. Yeah, unfortunately, tenants are in a position where pushing back means that they might not have somewhere to live. So you can feel quite powerless. There are some online groups as well that we identify in the series of tenants coming together to be able to support each other, and also contacting tenants' unions as well are always great sources of information.
Well, Ray, thanks so much for the chat. Ray Johnston, host of Download This Show. You can find out more in the series The Renter Algorithm. The first episode came out last Friday. The next episode comes out at 5:30 p.m. on ABC Radio National. Search for Download This Show on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts, and you can get the full story there. But right now, you're listening to Life Matters with me, Tegan Taylor. Coming up next, comedian Luke McGregor went digging into his Scottish ancestry, and he found a very grisly chapter in his family history. I would love to know what surprise discoveries you've made in researching your own family tree. How much do you know about your family history? Have you peered through the branches of your ancestral tree and made some interesting discoveries? Or maybe, like comedian, actor, and writer Luke McGregor, you know very little about your ancestry at all. It is Family History Month, and in a moment you'll hear about the trip Luke made to connect to his clan's past and how it changed him. But I would love to know about you, what you found when you delved into your family history, what it meant to connect to those stories in your family's past. You're actually already telling me your stories. I will share some with you in a second. But first, Luke McGregor, he's part of the new season of Sean McAuliffe's Origin Odyssey on SBS. Luke, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Much appreciated.
I'm thinking with a surname like McGregor, I can guess where you went to discover your past.
That's right, Japan. it was one of those, you know, names I've seen in, you know, films like Braveheart or Rob Roy McGregor. So I sort of had a vague idea of, like, I know it's Scottish, but then Conor McGregor's from Ireland. So, it was one of those ones I've always wanted to dig into, but just never got around to doing.
What was it like actually physically going to Scotland to have this odyssey?
It was really lovely. My wife's Indigenous, and so we've been out on country in Australia. That was kind of, I've sort of got to experience it through my family, but not with the direct connection that they have. So when I went to Scotland, it was kind of, I don't know, it felt like, and I don't know if it's just in my head, but it felt like home when I got there. Here feels like home too, but that really felt, I don't know, it felt deeper somehow, or it was really lovely to think that I've had, you know, a line of ancestry going back so far. It didn't feel like going somewhere new. It felt like coming home. It was really lovely.
Did you expect to feel like that?
I didn't, not really. I didn't, not initially anyway. I just thought it would be, you know, a cool, you know, trip down, not memory lane, but history lane. I don't know if that's what I was saying, but then when I got there, it felt a bit more, because I'm not really a religious person, but it did feel kind of spiritual, I guess. It felt like I could feel it in my bones, as opposed to just sort of the, you know, the intellectual, you know, interest of just saying, oh, that's where someone I am related to died or something like that.
So when you were on this trip, you discovered that for a while that it was illegal to be a McGregor in Scotland, which,
right?
What on earth is going on there?
Oh, I'm glad that law changed by the time I got there. From my understanding is that the English Empire trying to take over Scotland, that the McGregors were one of the ones that became very annoying, and therefore were outlawed, and, you know, attempts to disband, and then, you know, name changes, and just making it really hard for McGregors to form a group, basically, to rebel. So, there was a period there where we were getting, you know, rounded up, or you just couldn't be a McGregor, basically, which is crazy to think that that was a part of my history, and I just never knew.
Well, you even went to a castle that belonged to your clan's arch enemies, probably the site of some pretty grisly stuff.
Yeah, and I was just looking at this pit in the ground that still had markings from chains that were just where they kept McGregors before they were executed. And I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to do. Like, Sean wanted me to jump in. I'm like, no, I don't think I will.
It's a trap.
It's just, right. I didn't know how to handle it. I was just like, this feels horrendous. And I don't know if there's any, I don't know. You know how they talk about, what do you call it, inherited trauma, or things your ancestors experienced, you might have a penchant to, like, whether it's genetic or I don't know, but it did feel very odd being there, and it wasn't. I ended up doing the same walk that they would have done when they were executed back in the day, and it was all a bit. I hope it makes for good TV, because I felt very uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's a really interesting. Yeah, you're sort of doing this in front of some cameras, and you're dealing with some pretty hectic stuff. You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. It's Family History Month, and I'm talking to Luke McGregor. He's a comedian, actor, and writer. You know who he is. I think we can add budding family historian to the list. He followed his family tree all the way back to Scotland for season two of Sean McAuliffe's Origin Odyssey on SBS. And I'm asking you about discoveries you've made researching your own family's past, some incredible stories, some incredible ancestors that you have. Laurel in Tasmania says, a few months before my grandma passed away at 97, she casually dropped into conversation that we had a witch in the family. Turns out we're related to Martha Carrier, the first person to be hanged for witchcraft in the Salem witch trials of the 1600s. Wow. Patty says, I'm a descendant of a saint and a sinner. Apparently a distant relative through my mum's lineage discovered two of our Irish ancestors from the 1600s. One was a murdering highwayman, another one destined to be Ireland's first saint. He died in France on his way to be canonised by the Pope. Through my grandfather, our Aussie background goes back to two Irish brothers who came for the gold rush on the good ship Woodbridge in 1848. Well, Luke, you're obviously from Australia these days. Who was your ancestor that came out from Scotland?
We had a great-grandfather who was in Scotland, and he was a rogue scholar, I think it's called. But he had a falling out with our family in Scotland. He moved to Australia. He put my grandfather in foster care. And then my grandfather had my father, obviously. So there was a complete disconnect between our family and our Scottish family, because that chain was broken when my grandfather was in foster care. So it was only my Auntie Joyce and Uncle Frank that started to look at our family tree, and then through them we're able to reconnect with our relatives in Scotland. Which we've got quite a lot of. It's only been sort of with the internet and social media that we've been able to sort of reconnect with them. But for a long time there, it was just completely cut off.
So you've described this trip as one of the best experiences you've ever had. What made it so special? It sounds like it was quite a complicated emotional experience.
Yeah, making out with Sean McAuliffe. No, it was great. It was, I think something I felt a bit jealous of, is my wife and their family's connection to country. It was just not something I felt like I had, where the land itself felt a part of who they are, and. I am an atheist, I suppose I'd call myself, and I don't really have any sort of religious, but it's not that I don't want that. Like, I think it's a lovely thing to have. And my wife knew their storying, and going to Scotland was kind of my chance to find that for myself. And my wife's lineage also goes to Scotland ancestry as well as Indigenous. And the clan that my wife is connected to fought with the McGregors back in the day. So there was a lovely double up there too. So yeah, it was lovely. And I'm not sure if the science of, Tegan, maybe you know better than me, but is there any science around, I'm sorry to throw a question at you, around inherited trauma or genetic markers to things that are ancestors' experiences we might have a penchant to in our own life, whether it's anxiety, for example, even though in our lives we don't necessarily have the need for the level of anxiety we have, because back in the day what they experienced was much far worse and we've inherited those markers.
There's definitely intergenerational trauma. I'm not the expert here, but we definitely hear about it. Maybe you need to participate in some research, Luke, to sort of get to the bottom of it. You're telling me your stories as well. Lee has texted in to say 25 years of research has revealed the amazing stories of my ancestors. Hoping to find a convict or two, I was stunned to discover I descend directly from 17 who arrived here in chains. Extraordinary stories of extraordinary people. I love them all and feel like I know them so well because of all the history our archives offer of them. I've recently published 4 books telling their stories. Was there a particular character in your history, Luke, that you kind of felt like you personally connected with?
Not so much a single character, more around the period where the MacGregors were actively fighting against the English. And it was, I tell a lie. I got to hold Rob Roy's sword. I completely forgot. there was a sword, in the documentary that I believe belonged to Rob Roy MacGregor, who is apparently a direct descendant of ours. Apparently, if you're a MacGregor, everyone says they're related to Rob Roy, but apparently I actually am. no offense to any other MacGregors out there. I love you all. But, I got to hold one of his swords, and it was incredible. I was hoping it would be like He-Man, where if I held it up, I'd start transforming into a really cool guy, but it didn't happen. But it was still awesome to feel it.
Well, Luke, I'm looking at a picture of Rob Roy MacGregor now. I definitely see the family resemblance. Actually, seamless segue for you here. Speaking of portraits, when you're not with your family tree, you're hosting Portrait Artist of the Year, which is coming back to ABC iView this Sunday. If anyone hasn't seen the first season, it's basically a competition where amateur and established artists create a portrait of a famous Australian sitting right there in front of them. Who have you got lined up this season?
We've got Danny Minogue, we've got Matthew Preston, we've got Australia's first official astronaut, who I really love chatting to. I'm actually not sure how much I'm allowed to spoil, but it's a packed season. But one thing that I really enjoyed finding out was that I feel like Danny Minogue is really famous and everyone sort of knows of her, but one thing I didn't know is that she paints rocks. Like her side hobby is that she collects rocks and then paints them.
Beautiful. I love that.
Right. It's just such a cool, and I'm like, so if you walk past a rock and you're like, that'd be a good rock to paint, you go, and she goes like, oh yeah, I'm always looking. It was just a little, I think there's just a level of vulnerability when people are sitting there getting painted, where your walls have to come down to allow that experience to take place, that we end up getting these little cool factoids from people that I just never thought I'd know. And it's made me also want to start painting rocks, because that is just something that if we want to, we can do as adults.
Now I want to know what goes into Danny Minogue's rock selection process for painting. I guess we'll have to watch Portrait Artist of the Year. Luke, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for talking to me, Tegan. I really appreciate it.
Luke MacGregor, comedian, actor, writer. His family history journey features in the new season of Sean McAuliffe's Origin Odyssey on SBS. That starts Tuesday, August 18th. And then also Portrait Artist of the Year comes back to ABC iView on Sunday. You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Thanks for your stories about family history as well. One says, after my mother died, we discovered that my great-grandfather had a previous family in Tasmania. Many children with identical names of the family we were related to in Melbourne. We were pleased my mum and her mother were not aware of it. It would have caused a lot of grief for them. Well, coming up next, we've all got a moral line in the sand, the thing that you wouldn't do even if there was a lot of money on the table. But how firm is that line? You've got a moral code, that set of rules and beliefs that shape how you view the world and how you participate in it. But there are factors that impact how we live our lives that maybe challenge our ethics. There was a story this week about a pilot who quit a 40-year aviation degree because of his concerns about climate change. Basically, during COVID, he was grounded. When it was time to return to the skies, he realised he didn't want to be part of that industry anymore. While he was stood down, he started a baking apprenticeship, which has turned into a new passion and career for him. It obviously worked for this guy, but not everyone would feel like they could afford to make this particular moral choice. Well, you're about to hear from our resident philosopher on it, but I'd also love to hear from you. Is there a big moment in your life where you chose your principles over the status quo? But here with me is Patrick Stokes, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Deakin University. He joins me fortnightly for a chat that I like to call Ask Aristotle. Pat, have you ever had to quit your job because of your ethics?
Do you know, I never have.
Because your job is ethics.
I don't know. I'd love to say that it's because I'm just such a, you know, morally perfect person. I've never had to make that choice. But there was actually a study a couple of years ago where they somehow, I don't know how they assessed this, but apparently they tried to work out if moral philosophers were more ethical than the population at large. And I think the data said no. And in fact, if anything, they're slightly worse.
What?
Because, of course, we're much better at coming up with excuses. We're much better at sort of finding justifications for why we do things.
Ah, nicely. Well played. Maybe I should change my career to become a moral philosopher so I can get away with more stuff.
Recruiting now.
Listening to this story about the airline pilot who basically was like, no, I don't want to be using this much avgas. I want to be baking bread instead. What questions did this story raise for you when you heard it?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's really fascinating that he's an airline pilot, actually, which is a profession which has a strong sense of vocation and a strong sense of identity, because it's a special job. It's dangerous. It has high risks associated with it. It takes years and years of training. To walk away from that must be incredibly difficult. But also admitting that you want to walk away from those professions can be hard too, and you want to go and be a baker or whatever. But I'm not questioning that. I if he's telling us that he genuinely decided that he wanted to make that ethical shift, that's a really huge, brave thing to do. My first thought was, well, where does that leave the passengers who need to get places? You know, it's fair enough for him to say he doesn't want to be part of this process anymore. But of course, there's lots of reasons why people fly, and some of them might be more, shall we say, morally justifiable than others.
Okay, I was thinking about this too. I've been thinking about this a lot, actually. That you could say that for any industry, though. You might kind of go, I personally don't want to be in an extractive industry, but people are still going to want to use the ore or petrol or whatever that's been extracted. Mm. That doesn't mean that you have to be in that industry.
No, well, that's true too. And there's always this interesting tension between, you know, I can clean my hands or clean my conscience. But it's not necessarily going to stop everything else that goes on. And again, some of this comes down to which things you think are more important, your own kind of personal moral status, which is a genuine and important sort of thing, or the consequences that happen, which is also genuine and important. And if you go too far down the other path, if you say it's only consequences, the philosopher Bernard Williams once said, you could end up morally obligated to take a job in a chemical weapons lab, because if you don't do it, someone else will take the job and they might do a better job and end up killing more people with chemical weapons than you would have.
Right.
So, which he thinks is silly. He thinks that's obviously can't be the case. So there is an interesting tension there between, again, and we talk about this all the time in this segment, between consequences and kind of your own moral status or your own sense of conscience.
But quitting job is one thing that you actually do have control over. So is that a really reasonable thing to do, or is it a pretty drastic way to express your ethics?
It's certainly drastic. It's probably going to come down to what the job is. You know, if you're a hitman or something, or if you're in a job that involves exploiting people's addictions or involves, you know, coercing people routinely, you might well then say, actually, the only morally viable thing for me to do is to quit. I think for most people, it's going to be more the case that it would be what we would call a supererogatory act. That is, it's a nice thing to do morally, but it's more than you have to do. It's above and beyond to quit your job. And it's also the case, too, that in a lot of these cases, focusing on individual responsibility, even though it's understandable, might be putting the emphasis in the wrong place. What might need to happen is systemic change. So if you're part of an industry that is causing widespread economic damage, let's say, your involvement in it might not be the problem. The system that allows that to happen might be the problem, or the way this industry is structured might be the problem.
You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Patrick Stokes from Deakin University. We're talking ethics, as usual, on a Thursday afternoon with Pat. I'm interested to know if you've had to make a big compromise or a big choice based on your ethics, especially around your career. Fiona has a story. She says, I had a senior position with a company and witnessed a meeting which I was then asked to lie about in court. When I refused, saying I would truthfully answer the questions asked, the anger proved how annoyed and serious they were. I left as I didn't want to work with a dishonest organisation. 2 years of legal threats followed to sue me and take my home. The company thought I would fold, but I didn't. It was a constant invasion into my personal life. So, Pat, it's not even just the industry. Sometimes it's the very particular workplace.
Yeah, and we've talked about whistleblowers in this segment before, right? And the idea that there's a kind of a moral courage to do what was just described then, you know, actually walking away can be incredibly hard. But it can also shift the focus, right? That sometimes that is how moral progress happens, is by somebody saying, hey, we can't keep doing this. This is wrong. And everyone goes, what are you talking about? This is what we've always done. It's absolutely fine. Moral progress generally takes the form, or very often takes the form, of coming to see that something we never even thought about before as being a problem might actually be really, really wrong, and we do have to stop doing things that way.
But what if you need to, I don't know, feed your children or put a roof over their head? Yeah. Like, when we're talking about our jobs, we're usually talking about our livelihood, and that's a really big personal cost you're wearing there.
It is, yeah. And again, this is going to come down to questions of degree, right? The sort of moral compromises where you have to actually walk away, even at enormous cost to yourself, that's going to be thankfully relatively rare, but it does happen. But in most cases, of course, the reality is that you're not necessarily going straight from quitting your job to, you know, homelessness and starvation. Like, these things can happen. For a lot of people, it's going to be just going to a job that's not as good or not as remunerative. But even that still involves some kind of sacrifice. And again, I think it's understandable. A lot of people would say, well, why should I have to wear the cost of that sacrifice while the system that I'm opting out of continues along as it is? So both of those things need to be considered, both individual responsibility and the need for systemic change.
Well, thankfully, right at this very moment, I don't feel like my job compromises my ethics. But if I do want to live a life more aligned with ethics, what's some good frameworks?
I think one of the first things to do in that case is just basically, like, if you're troubled by something, if you're starting to look at what you do in your job or at anything else, and you're starting to worry about it, starting to niggle at you, that you're thinking, oh, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing here. I think the first thing to do is to try and work out where that conflict is coming from. What is the tension? What is the principle that your current actions are in tension with? And is it a sort of a stretch of your principles that you can accommodate for some other principled reason, or is it just genuinely intolerable? And then you need to work out, you know, if you make the break, how you make the break, and what would a life in accordance with whatever your principles are look like. So it involves a bit of moral imagination, involves a bit of prospective imagining what a better future might look like, not just critiquing the situation you're in now.
We're glad to say you are not genuinely intolerable, Pat. Thank you, as always, for chatting with me.
I thought I was.
No, you're great. Patrick Stokes, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Deakin University, joins me fortnightly for a chat that I call Ask Aristotle. It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Well, earlier in the show, we were talking about the little quirky, sometimes ugly things that makes a city recognisable. Canberra's bus shelters have just been heritage listed. And I spoke to architecture advocate Izzy White about what it is about designs like this that affect how we interact with the city as we move through it. Here's a little bit of what she had to say to me earlier.
Heritage listing is important. And there are things, of course, that we should protect. But I do wonder sometimes if we could just have a better attitude towards renovation and reuse rather than demolition. And I think if we were able to do that better, we could probably rely less on protections, which come with their own sort of difficulties when you're trying to move and evolve cities with contemporary needs. I should say, though, that one of the issues with renovating and reusing is that it's a lot more work for a modern day developer to be able to peel apart an old piece of structure and work out if the materials are safe or contaminated or if the building codes have changed. And we haven't made it easy enough for developers to do that. It's basically easier to come in and demolish and start again. And so if we do want to see better reuse in our cities of things that we love, we've really got to change the way that we sort of set up all of our systems to let modern development happen.
Izzy White, architecture advocate, speaking to me earlier in the show. You can catch that full chat by searching Life Matters in ABC Listen, because it has been Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land today. Beverly Wang will be with you tomorrow. I'll catch you again on Monday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.